Disability Talk from the BBC with Simon Minty and Kate Monaghan.
Hello. It's an interesting one today.
Ooh, I like an interesting one, Simon.
Well, with the closure of a 220-year-old school for deaf children, we're going to look at why the deaf community care so much still if we're meant to be educated altogether in the mainstream. It also is a real insight into deaf culture, sign language, and that stuff's always interesting.
Yeah, something I had pretty much no experience of at all before looking into it today. I always knew deaf culture was a little bit separate to disability culture, perhaps, but I didn't really understand it. But I got to go to a school for deaf children last week, and it was a real fascinating insight into the deaf community.
We will have that coming up shortly.
We will. But to start the programme, we're talking about becoming a parent, something that fills me with anxiety at the thought that that could ever happen.
A lot of people do it.
A lot of people do it. And for some disabled women, pregnancy can be risky, complicated, and indeed downright painful. But then I guess that's the same for all women. But why do they do it if there are so many risks? Over Christmas, it emerged that disability rights campaigner Callia Franklin, founder of the Broken of Britain website, had given birth to a child. Though the usually very connected campaigner had not mentioned a word of her pregnancy on social media. Callia's on the phone to us now. Hello, Callia.
Hi, Kate.
Hello. That was such a surprise when I logged on and I saw on Facebook, oh my gosh, Callia's popped out a baby. What the heck happened?
Well, we didn't keep the pregnancy a secret or anything, but, you know, on my Twitter, there's about 10,000 people who I don't know. So we made a decision that, you know, pregnancy is stressful for everyone, and a little bit more so if you have a disability, and that the extra pressure of social media was something that we could avoid. So,
and what's your baby called?
His name is Nye.
Nye. And what was the reasoning behind Nye?
Well, we needed a name that both of his parents liked, which was quite challenging.
Yeah.
And we really liked Nye, but also he's named after Nye Bevan because we had such amazing healthcare, really, while having him. And it was very much on our minds that how lucky we were to have that kind of consistent free care. Whenever there was a problem, you know, the hospital were there to sort it out immediately.
And Nye Bevan being, for anyone who doesn't know, I know, obviously, because it's written in my notes.
And we had a meeting beforehand where
yeah.
we explained
where
it.
Where we told me what it was. Nye Bevan was a post-war Labour minister who built the National Health Service. So it's quite a solid name, that, isn't it?
Yeah. It is. Presumably, you've done the compulsory new parent thing. Are you all over social media now with photos of your wonderful child?
Absolutely. I'm trying to ration myself, but it's very difficult because obviously my child is amazing.
Fantastic. And in our Caversham studio, we have Beth Whitby. She's a mum to a 2-year-old, Edith. Hi there, Beth.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Now, we've got you on because, you have SMA, which is spinal muscular atrophy, a condition which, well, it makes it a little bit complex, doesn't it, having a child? And when you had your maternal thoughts, they kicked in. Had it been in your head for quite a while? Had you sort of hesitations and thoughts? What made you take the plunge?
Well, I'd been considering it for a while because I had been with my husband a while and both of my brothers had children, so it just sort of seemed like the natural course of things for me. But obviously I knew that it was going to be more complicated, so I had to consult with my GP and my consultant and various people just to find out exactly what the risks were for me and what the chances are of my child inheriting my condition were.
So it's the both side. It's the kind of the complications for you, but then also for the child. And how is Edith in that sense? Has your SMA been passed on?
No. She will definitely be a carrier for my disability because my disability is such that because I've got it, she can't avoid that. But she's at the moment, she's shown no signs of having got it, and the chances were relatively low. So.
Did you always think you'd be able to have children, or did you always assume you could have kids? Did you assume you couldn't have kids and then something changed your mind? How did you view the possibility of children as you were growing up?
I think I always knew that it was going to be a challenge and something to think about. In my head, I had always thought that I'd have to look up surrogacy as an option if I was told that I wasn't going to be able to carry the child. But I think I just decided to look into it, and I found some cases of people with very similar type of my disability that had had children, and of course there'd been some difficulties, but it was possible. So
you were kind of determined, no matter what, even if it meant surrogacy, that children were going to play a part of your life.
Yeah, absolutely. It was definitely something that I wanted.
So. And what did how did your consultant react when you went in and said, you know what, I want to have a baby? What's going to happen? Did he throw his hands up in horror and say, oh my gosh, no way? Or did he say, okay, well, this is possible, but...
No, not too, because I had sort of warned him that the few times before that question might be coming.
Right.
So he wasn't completely shocked, and he had his answers all ready for me. Yeah, he was fairly positive. He was realistic about what things I may or may not have difficulty with, but my disability is such that it varies so hugely from person to person that you just sort of have to know yourself, what you feel your capabilities are, along with those risks, and make a decision to go for it.
You mentioned that bit about seeing other people with your condition who's had children. I mean, I'm trying to... Baroness Jane Campbell's probably the most famous person with the same condition as you, although she doesn't have children. So there were people you'd read about and you thought, well, if they can, I can, type thing?
Yeah, I contacted the charity which supports people with my disability, and I asked them if they had any contacts for people that had children with my type of SMA, and they sent me a magazine article, which actually I do remember having seen before, but I'd lost, about a lady that had very similar level of need to me. So I used that to sort of prepare myself for what medical problems there may be or difficulties. But other than that, there really wasn't a lot to help me other than just giving it a go.
Now, Kalia, you have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is the same disability that I have.
Snap.
High five to that. Did you go and seek advice from your consultants before you decided to get pregnant, or did you just sort of not worry about it too much?
I'd had some advice years ago. 10, 12 years ago, a local obstetrician told me that I definitely shouldn't have children because I'd have a 50% chance of dying from it.
Wow.
But I spoke to Professor Bird because obviously I was quite troubled by that, and he dismissed it as mistaken nonsense, which it was.
Professor Bird is one of the leading experts in EDS, for anyone who doesn't know.
Thanks, Kate.
Pleasure. He's a good egg, that one.
He is. He gave me some very wise advice at the time in relation to disability and parenting. And he said that whatever the risks were, he didn't think it was any doctor, and particularly any man's place, to tell a woman what they should or shouldn't do in relation to having children. And that stayed with me.
Interesting.
And did you take advice before you got pregnant? Did you go for genetic counselling or any of that kind of thing?
We didn't, partly because the pregnancy was a bit of a wonderful surprise. But I knew all along that, you know, there's a 50-50 chance of inheritance. But as you know, Kate, the problem with so many people with EDS is we're not diagnosed until late in life, after we've become quite impaired. And those who do inherit it and are diagnosed as children and get the right support tend not to have the same levels of disability as those of us who don't.
Yeah.
I had a little experience with genetic counselling when, about 20 years ago, my family are all average size, but I'm the person with the disability, I'm the short person, and my sister was pregnant, and when she was going through the process, they found out about me being part of the family history, and my sister came back from the genetic counsellor quite upset, which then upset me, so I said, could I go along and meet the genetic counsellor and have a conversation? And it was just bizarre. I mean, it may have been the time...
Why was she upset? What upset her?
So they came up with a lot of concerns about if her child had my condition. And
right.
I was saying to my sister, well, hang on, you've grown up with me, so you know everything. So why are you getting a bit... So it was a really slightly awkward bit with me and my sister. My brother-in-law was fabulous. He said, why would we care? We know you, so it's all OK. There was this curious bit at the end. The genetic counsellor tried to re-diagnose me. She thought I might have a different condition, which was quite... Person, or was
a different commit. What, she didn't think you were short?
Yeah, of course not that one, she can tell that much. No, there are very many different conditions. You're loving your wit, aren't you? There are very many different types of short stature, and I have one of them, and she was thinking it was another one. But at the end of this conversation, she said, if you ever decide to have a child, you must come and see me first. And I said, that's very kind, I don't fancy you enough, but I appreciate the offer. But there was some sort of pertinence there. And I almost thought before we had this, did you feel, Kayla or Beth, did you feel you should have to have this? Or was you pushed down a route?
I did have it, actually.
Okay.
But that was a choice that I decided to make purely to find out the chances that our child would have my condition. It wasn't necessarily going to affect my decision to have a child. I'd already decided to do that. But I did go for genetic counselling because I didn't know all the statistics of what the chances are that they would have my disability and whether it would be the same type and that sort of thing. And my brothers, when they had their children, also made the decision whether or not to go for genetic counselling. So
we are very fortunate. We have an expert down the line, Dr. Tom Shakespeare, who's from the University of East Anglia. Tom is himself disabled and, amongst other things, has a research interest in social and ethical aspects of genetics. Presumably this is all familiar territory to you, Tom.
Yeah, fairly familiar. It's great that Beth and Kalia have had babies. I'm really, really pleased about that. Obviously, loads and loads of disabled people are having kids these days, and I think it's because we're more empowered and we're less likely to be institutionalised, and it reflects the fact that we're at a more included state in British society.
And in terms of this screening, Tom, I mean, what are mothers routinely screened for at present? We're talking about Downs or spina bifida. Is this because that's what we know so far? Is there a lot more research going into other conditions? Or is it just because they're the cheap and easy one? Is it ethical or is it actually a bit practical, what we actually know?
Sure. It's a bit of both, really. I mean, one is the frequency. Because, for example, Down syndrome comes along at about 1 in 1,000 births. If you're over 35, it's 1 in 400 births. That's really quite common compared to SMA, which is 1 in 10,000 births, and Ehlers-Danlos, there's lots of different types, but I've read figures of 1 in 5,000 births. So it's about, I'm afraid, cost effectiveness. You wouldn't offer a test for a rare condition to everybody when the vast, vast majority of people are not going to be affected. Down syndrome and spina bifida are reasonably common.
Right.
In the case of spina bifida, obviously you can take folate supplementation, which vastly reduces the incidence of spina bifida. In the case of Down syndrome, and obviously there are also terminations of pregnancy, in the case of Down syndrome, it's really only termination of pregnancy if you want to prevent that birth or have your babies earlier.
Can I just bring Kalia in? Kalia, did you have screenings offered to you? Did you take them up? And if you'd found out that your kid had Down syndrome or spina bifida, or indeed if he had Ehlers-Danlos, would that have changed your mind about keeping him?
We didn't have the screening because neither my partner or I felt that it would make any difference to carrying on with the pregnancy. We did accidentally screen for spina bifida because our midwife was deaf and she didn't hear me saying that we didn't want the screening. But that was a mistake.
Then would it yeah,
oh, how easy is it, a visual check? I mean, I thought they would be.
It is, yeah. I think the spina bifida is a visual one, isn't it?
Oh, is it?
Well, it's a combination.
Oh, thanks, Tom.
There's a blood test which is for both spina bifida and for Down syndrome, and also there is obviously the ultrasound, and there's a measurement, for example, for Down syndrome of a little fold on the neck. And that is very predictive of whether a child will be affected.
Tom, you yourself have had children. Did you have screenings that were offered to you?
No. I've got two children in their late 20s with my condition, achondroplasia. And, you know, I feel that achondroplasia doesn't stop you having a good life. And so, therefore, I wasn't bothered about the tests or screening. Because if I should add to what I've said, because I've been talking about Down syndrome and spina bifida, for those families that know they're affected by a rare disorder, like Ehlers-Danlos, or like my condition, achondroplasia, or Simon's condition, you would be offered the test because you've got probably a 50-50 or a 1 in 4 chance of having an affected child. So it does make sense to offer people the test. The only other point I want to make is that, you know, 90% of people who are screened for Down syndrome, who are found to have a pregnancy affected by Down syndrome, terminate. And I think that we have to be very careful how we discuss these things.
Hold on, 90% of people terminate?
90% of people whose pregnancies are found to be affected by Down syndrome terminate the pregnancy.
That is a huge number. How do you change that mindset?
I think one of the things is that we give people balanced information about disability. I could tell you I have a G2A transposition at 380 of my 0.380 of my FGFR3 gene, and it made absolutely no difference to you. But if I say, look, I've had a good life, I've been to university, I've had two kids, I've got a partner and all the rest of it, you go, okay, right, so, you know, you can have a good life with your condition. And I think it's that's the information about the social experience of people, you know, like Beth, like Kalia, like all of ourselves. We need to make that more available to parents who know nothing. Most, you know, the vast majority of parents diagnosed with any of these conditions know nothing about it. They're worried, they're frightened, and they would rather avoid it.
And perhaps that's the distinction that those of us who've got the experience will obviously come at this from a very different angle. And whilst I might get the routine screening, I'd be like, well, it's only just to make it practical so I can prepare. It's not for any other reason necessarily. But I'd imagine if I was, like my parents, they had no idea I was coming, and this was all pretty scary stuff at that point. I mean, Tom, you did have a website, and I take your point. Ultimately, it's about the individual making that decision, but it's about giving them the information. You had the website, which kind of gave both sides, or gave them
lots
of information.
It was called Antenatal Answer, Antenatal Screening Web Resource, and we were funded to do it. And we interviewed people with Down syndrome and cystic fibrosis and spine bifida and several other conditions. And we put photographs and interview material up on this website. That was, you know, 10 years ago, and the funding ran out and it stopped. But I think the NHS really has an obligation. If they're spending a lot of money on screening, they should spend a little money on balanced information, because it's all about informed consent. And in my opinion, it's, you know, I'm not going to criticize any woman who has a test or any woman who has a termination, because that is, I think we heard the consultant referred to earlier, that's an intensely private decision for that woman and her partner. But what I do want is for her and her partner to get balanced information and no pressure, no coercion.
That was really interesting. Thank you so much, Tom. We're going to say goodbye to you now.
Look forward to hearing it. Bye now.
All right, thanks. Beth, if you could have screened it out in the first place and had and chosen to have a baby who definitely didn't have SMA, if you could have screened out maybe the sperm at that point in the conception, or would it did it really make no difference whatsoever?
It really didn't make any difference. The only reason I went for the genetic counselling and testing to see if my husband was a carrier was just to find out if the chances were 1 in 1,500 or 50% that the child would have SMA. And then if it had been the case that he was a carrier, then we just would have prepared ourselves for the increased likelihood that our child would have SMA. No. But I wouldn't ever have removed that risk, because my personal opinion is that there could be something else in either of our gene pools that is sitting there dormant and we know nothing about, and that could rear its head, and you there comes a point when you just have to let nature take its course to a certain extent. Not saying that it's never the right decision to do that, but personally for me, there was never really any choice to carry on.
And both of you, I mean, maybe Beth first, but you, both of you have support for yourselves in terms of living with the impairment and day-to-day activities and so on. Did you get, and I have to ask this clunky question, when you said I'm having a child, and then people, did you get any raised eyebrows saying, well, hang on, how are you going to look after a child because you need some support to do your own daily living? Were there any raised eyebrows like that? Did you get feel any little bit of judgment kicking around?
I think there's always an element of that, not so much from the professionals, but just from perhaps people that know you. It's mind-blowing enough for some people that I have a job and I drive, let alone that I've got married and I'm having a baby. So there is a little bit of that, but I think it's just a lack of awareness that is a possibility, and that there's support for that, and that it's not really such a big problem.
I mean, and Kalia, the fact maybe that links back to your bit of you kept it quiet from social media because you were expecting some sort of trolling. I mean, what about the people who know and love you? Presumably they were absolutely relaxed about it, or did you get a couple of eyebrows raised?
I think you always get a couple of eyebrows raised, although I'm not sure whether they were just because people didn't expect me to have children because of my age. I don't know. I certainly felt that there was quite a lot of sort of eugenics in a way to pregnancy care, unconscious eugenics, I think. But it is very much all about kind of this attempt to screen out defects. And I find that I found that really quite troubling, because every time they mentioned a condition, I thought of a person with a name.
Yeah, yeah. What was pregnancy like for you then? What was it like to be to be pregnant? Was it harder than a pregnancy for a non-disabled woman, or was it kind of okay?
I think pregnancy is really quite tough for all women, even the women who do pregnancy very well. And certainly with EDS, there's such a hormonal impact on women. And so, to be honest, pregnancy was mostly like having the worst EDS flare I've ever had in my life.
Oh, God, that sounds awful.
I'm finding having a newborn much less tiring than being pregnant was towards the end.
Really?
Really. Certainly. Jeez. Physically. You know, I gained an enormous amount of weight in fluid mostly. So it was very difficult to get around. I was very short of breath and just kind of really exhausted. But it was all worth it.
And Beth, what was pregnancy like for you?
Well, actually, it was a lot easier than I imagined, because I'd been given lots of, you know, worst case scenarios. And for me, actually, the hardest bits were the morning sickness and the heartburn, which anyone can get. So I found that pregnancy actually made me feel quite good until the very end, when it did. It slightly affect my breathing, which is why the decision was made for me to have her early. But for actually the period in between, I felt surprisingly good.
And Kelly, there was something you said which was quite strong, that bit about there's that sort of sense of eugenics around the screening. Now, if I hear that someone who could have had a baby who's going to be short with a similar condition to mine, and they don't, I'm devastated. I mean, I almost take that as a sort of personal slight, which is a little bit daft, but you can't help it. But, I mean, I suppose there's a double question for me. One, which is there a point, or are there some conditions that you would say, actually, I think it is sensible to screen for them? Maybe I should let you answer that one before.
I think it's really important not to judge women for their decisions, like Tom was saying. So if women want screening and then they decide to terminate, I find that terribly sad. Mm. But it's not my place to make that judgment on any woman, because I don't think any woman ever takes that decision lightly.
But what about you personally? Was there a line for you that you thought, actually, if they have this condition, then perhaps?
I think if they told us that the baby had a condition where, for example, it's got a proper medical name, but I don't know it. Basically, the baby develops without a brain at all, and so they can't survive outside the womb. I think maybe if they'd said something like that, we might have seriously considered a termination. But mostly what we felt in relation to disability was that, you know, I have a good life. I know lots and lots of disabled people with a huge range of impairments who are having great lives, and that disability just wasn't a reason.
I suppose my flip, that second part of the question, would be, what about the reverse then? Should we get to the point where, say, if I had a child, I'd say, actually, I want the child to have my condition. If we're saying we don't want screening there, can you start selecting now? Can we say we can choose genetic differences?
I find the whole idea of genetic engineering in that way really quite disturbing. I think that when any couple have a baby, it is essentially a genetic lottery. And in some ways, people like us have the advantage, because we know what conditions our children might inherit. But where would it then stop? Would we be screening out fetuses because there's a history of Alzheimer's in the family, for example? Mm. I think everybody with babies, you kind of get what you're given, and that's the way it's meant to work, and moving towards any kind of positive selection is really very disturbing.
I think there is a certain level of irony of us as disabled people all sitting around talking about the level at which we would terminate a pregnancy, when possibly all of us could have been terminated had, you know, our parents known. I mean, maybe not our particular parents, I don't know, but look at us now, how great we are living our lives.
Happy New Year.
I just find it very interesting.
Oh, it's so complex, and I'm with you, Kelly, I think that's a very interesting take. The flip side of me then says, if we say you get what you're given, but we have so much medical stuff to help us once we exist now. Mm. 100 years' time, 200 years' time, yeah. Is this conversation going to be so different?
Because I was thinking, where would I draw my line? And one of the things that I was thinking was, well, if I had a baby who was in constant pain, would I be able to kind of cope with bringing that into into the world, and would that be okay? And then I thought, actually, hold on, Kate, you're in constant pain. Should my mum and dad not have brought me in because I would be in constant pain? I think, actually, no. It's a really difficult one. But getting back to the babies, as our guests, rather than just my personal view, Beth, how are you getting on sort of caring day to day for your little girl, Edith? She's 2 now?
Yeah, nearly 2 and a half. So, doing really well. I have. I'm very fortunate that I have a 24-hour care package, as well as my husband and family nearby. So, I have good support. Although it is somewhat changeable. I've had quite a few carers leave, which can be difficult. Obviously, getting to know my daughter and everything. But generally, it's going well. There were teething problems at the beginning, but now it's going well.
Callia, do you think there's more support in place for parents who have a disabled child rather than disabled parents having a child?
I think so, but I think it's also really important to state that there's not sufficient help in place for parents with disabled children. So it's not like, everything's perfect there, but there is more support than there is for disabled parents.
I still have moments where I hear stories, and although Tom's not here anymore, I'm sure he probably gets some of these messages, where parents do have a child that has a disability and they have to go straight, they Google it. This is almost like the first thing, rather than having being steered in the right direction and so on. Maybe that's one of the things, that bit about education and knowledge, both pre and post, is absolutely critical.
Yeah. It's been lovely talking to you. Just in summary, I guess, Callia and Beth, is it worth it? Is it worth all the risks? Is it worth all the trouble to have a child?
We know the answer.
Absolutely.
Yay!
It's worth every moment.
Have we got pictures? Will they go up on the website?
I'm sure we can get some pictures.
Are we allowed that? Maybe you don't want your children to be part of your whole public profile. You might be quite private, but that would be fun.
Thank you, Callia Franklin and Beth Whitby. Coming up,
we're gonna make damn noise, though the whole world can feel the death hype. We're gonna make damn vibrations, though the whole world can feel the death hype.
Check out those vibrations. That was Kidult and MC Geezer with Death Hype, and you can hear the whole of that track at the end of the programme.
Now, after 220 years, the Royal School for Deaf Children in Margate has closed its doors, leaving 21 schools left that actually cater for deaf children. Though there has been a push towards getting kids into mainstream school these last 30 years, many deaf people bemoan their loss. And that's because they can see deaf culture, spelt with a capital D, crumbling a little. Our guests today are here to talk about deaf education and about this sign language culture and community that a lot of people don't know about.
So let's say hello to these guests in our King's Lynn studio. Who knew we had a studio in King's Lynn? Did you, Simon?
No.
No, me neither, but that's where she is. We have Katie Rayworth. Hello, Katie.
Hello.
Now, you're mum to 4-year-old Xavier, who's deaf and will be going to school for the first time this September because he currently attends nursery. Yep. Now, you were somewhat thrown into the deep end when Xavier was born because you have no experience of deafness or sign language.
No, none.
Do you feel like you're having to play catch up a bit so that he can learn sign language too? What's that like?
I obviously have to teach Xavier sign language, which is not my first language. So I then have to learn sign language to teach Xavier. So that's quite difficult. He's picking it up, but he's certainly quite far behind with his language development at the moment.
And in Leeds, waiting to talk to us is deaf filmmaker and journalist Charlie Swinburne. He's also the editor of the Limping Chicken blog. Hi there, Charlie.
Hi there.
So let's hear your deaf credentials. You were born into a deaf family, weren't you?
Absolutely. I was born into a deaf family, but I went to mainstream school. My deafness is moderate to severe. So I've got experience of the mainstream side, but my parents both went to a specialist school for the deaf. So I've had, awareness of how they grew up as well.
Mm-hmm.
And in our studio here in London, we have Tomato Lychee from campaign group Deaf London. Tomato was deaf from birth and was educated in mainstream school. He didn't learn sign language until he was 25 years old. Now, today, Tomato is speaking through a British Sign Language interpreter, who is a female, confusingly. So, Tomato, how did you avoid sign language for so long?
To be honest, I grew up, you know, in a mainstream school, and it was just all about oral skills, learning how to communicate with your mouth. It was never sign language. And if you needed anything in detail, you'd need to write everything down. So a lot of stuff was missed out. But, you know, English was my first language. You know, I could barely speak as it was. So writing and reading was more of my first language than anything.
I've been excited every time I've said your name. Having a surname Minty, I kind of get smiles and so on. How did Tomato come about?
Well, I grew up. I wasn't really involved in the deaf community at all. I was brought up with a lot of hearing people. I went to, you know, university. I went through depression. I had a breakdown. I had quite a terrible life, really. But then I decided to change my name. I just randomly picked this name. There was no reason for it, but this is my name now, and I think it's sort of part of my deaf culture as well.
I'm sure we're going to delve into that a little bit more. I mean, as you've already heard, the ways deaf people learn and communicate can vary wildly. Now, none of our guests actually attended a school for deaf kids, but the other day Kate went to one, and this was the Frank Barnes School. It's in London, and you went to speak to a few of the children there.
First, we come to Christina, who's aged 10.
Yeah, I grew up going to a deaf unit, so then I moved to Frank Barnes. The deaf unit was separate to the mainstream school, so we were separate from the hearing children. And we'd sign in there with the teachers, but if I went into the hearing school, I was lost. Well, I didn't understand anything. I can't lip read. The teachers would just talk at me. There'd be loads of different teachers, and then there'd be some that'd be able to sign in my unit.
That must have been hard.
Yeah, really emotional when you don't understand.
Are any of your family deaf?
They're all hearing. Mum has a really small about, and Dad can't sign at all. Like, they're hearing, so they don't sign.
So how do you communicate with your parents?
Mum wants to learn sign language, so I'm trying to teach her so then she can understand me. Dad, he really doesn't like it. He wants me to be able to speak. So I just have to put up with it. My brother has a little bit of sign language as well, but he finds it hard.
So how many people are in your class, and what are your lessons like?
In my class there are 4 children, and Catherine teaches me, and she signs. She's deaf as well. And there are other staff in the class, and they support some of the children, some of my friends. So there's other adults there too. So there's one teacher, and then there are 3 support staff.
That was Christina, and this is Jaden, who's 8. Is anyone in your family, are they deaf?
So my mum and dad are deaf, but I've got one brother, and he's hearing. And he speaks, but he wants to learn how to sign properly, so I teach him every day. We do fingerspelling, and finally he's improving, so Zach can sign now. So my brother really wishes that he was deaf.
Why does your brother wish he was deaf?
Zach can see that I find it really difficult to lip read him, so he wants to be able to sign properly. And I say to him, don't worry, it's okay, you can sign. You can, I can understand you. And I want him to be here at Frank Barnes.
But he can't because he's not deaf.
Yeah, you need to be deaf to come to Frank Barnes.
Where are you going to go to school for secondary school? Will you go to a school for deaf children, or will you go to a mainstream school?
I definitely want to go to a deaf secondary school.
And why is that?
Maybe some of my friends who are in older years above me now might go to deaf secondary school, and then I might be able to see them again in a deaf school.
Do you think it would be a good thing to have friends who are hearing, or would you rather not have any friends who are hearing?
No, I don't need hearing friends, I just need deaf friends. Because all around the world there are deaf people, and if all the deaf schools close and they're closing their doors on all the deaf people, then there won't be enough schools for them. And if they whittle down in numbers, there just won't be enough places for deaf children. I want them all to stay open, all of the deaf schools.
Would it not be nice for hearing and deaf children to all mix together in the same school, though?
No, I just want to be around deaf people.
Why?
Because in a deaf school, the teachers can all sign, and I want to be with people who can sign and for everybody to improve their sign language. And I really hope that I can improve, learn loads, get stickers, get rewards. And I want in the future to get really, really good and be proud of my deaf identity.
That was Christina and Jaden from Frank Barnes School there, and the interpreter was Becca. Now, I think one of the things that struck me when I was meeting and chatting to these kids was what a tough time they'd all had at mainstream school before they went into a deaf school, and then how their lives had really changed when they went into a deaf school. And I was not really prepared for that. I don't think I'd realised how hard it would be at a mainstream school. Now, Katie, you're about to look at schools for Xavier. Do you have worries about the kind of schools that you're going to be putting Xavier into?
Sorry, I'm a bit emotional.
I'm sorry about that. What's made you feel so emotional?
It's difficult to hear that from a child that is the same as Xavier. It's difficult for me to hear.
Which bit in particular?
If it's a bit that makes me feel a bit strange, is the bit where he says, I only want to hang out with other deaf kids.
Yes, that got me a bit.
Are you happy to continue?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sorry, excuse me.
Not at all. It made me jump a little bit.
Yes, it is a concern. Obviously it is. Because I can't ask him what he wants. I can only do what I think is best for him, and that might not be the case.
So what are your options for schools for him?
Xavier will be going to a mainstream school in September with two communication support workers with him.
So, and how do you feel about that?
Well, I'm anxious about it because he won't be the only deaf child there. There are two others at that mainstream school, but they have amplification. So Xavier will be the only child using BSL as his first language.
Amplification, and that means, does that mean hearing aids?
Hearing aids or cochlear implants.
Okay.
So Xavier doesn't have either of those things. He only communicates with British Sign Language, and he is non-verbal as well. So that is his only form of communication. So he will be, well, isolated, if you like, but then he already is, so...
And do you have the option of a deaf school near you, or is that not an option
there
at
are.
All?
There are no deaf schools near me.
But he's doing what, and I'm going to throw this out to everybody, but I think the numbers now are showing the vast majority, we said at the top of the show, the vast majority of deaf kids will go to a mainstream school, which is very different from perhaps 30, 40 years ago. And also, 20, 34 years ago, that was the campaigning, to have integration, inclusion, and have everybody together. And there's a really clumsy way that I sometimes think, and maybe it might be slightly harder for the child at school at that point, but will be better in the inverted commas big world. However, is it better to have it easier at school and then a bit more difficult in the real world? Maybe Tomato, you've kind of had a bit of an experience of going through that mainstream stuff, and with hindsight, would you prefer deaf school? Can you see both ways?
To be honest, yeah, I've been through something quite similar to that, and you know, I went to mainstream, there was no sign language there, to be very honest. I achieved quite a lot in school. But the only problem that I had was I left school with an awful mental health issue, emotional issues. You know, I had such a terrible, terrible upbringing that, you know, my secondary school that I got involved with afterwards, I was in the same sort of area for 5 years with 30 hearing schools. I never knew any of their names. And then at the end of the 5 years, I still didn't know their name. So that's, to me, a really bad experience. And I just wanted to pick up on, is it Katie?
Mm.
Yeah.
I just wanted to, you know, your son saying that he just wants deaf friends because they can sign. And
that was the audio.
Sorry, not somebody else. But it's interesting that somebody deaf only wants deaf friends. It doesn't matter, obviously, if they're hearing or they're deaf, but the main thing is that they are really good at sign language because, of course, we all know communication is key and that's how everybody understands each other. And obviously, you know, for someone to have two languages, English and British Sign Language, I think that would be amazing.
You were referring to Jaden on our audio there. And I think Tomato's experience of school would be very different to Xavier's, because you're putting in lots and lots of support for Xavier going into primary school, aren't you? What kinds of support is Xavier going to have?
He's going to have two communication support workers. He'll have input from his teacher of the deaf on a daily basis and other deaf adults as well as role models. So he will have quite a lot of input from professionals.
I mean, maybe can we dig a little bit deeper? And Charlie, I always come to you for the, I mean, deaf culture and what we call the big D, as in spelling or writing deaf with a capital D as distinct from a little d, particularly in the middle of a sentence. What is that deaf culture? How would you explain it?
I think it's really the difference between seeing deafness as a cultural thing and not being like a barrier or something that's like a medical issue. And it's really referring to people who use BSL, who use sign language, and feel a sense of pride in their deaf identity and feel a sense of belonging when they're around other deaf people.
I can't have a what I call dwarf culture, capital D, little d. Oh, there's probably too many clashes there. I might be on my own. Is the essence, though, the difference, perhaps, because you've got a language? It's not a written language, which is cultural sometimes, but it's because it has BSL. That's the thing that is distinct.
Yeah, I think it's the language in two respects. And one is obviously that you've got the language that links people together. That's BSL. It's a visual language. It's you know, it's got a different structure to English. It's very distinct. But it's also secondly that through your deafness, you are somewhat separated, I guess, from the rest of the world. So as well as having your own language, you also, you know, you're more able to use that language with a certain select group of other people. So that's really what creates that strong culture.
There's nothing better. I mean, I don't know if you've heard this, Kate. And if I hang out with a lot of other short people, I call it the shot in the arm. You have that immense pride. You have all that commonality that you all come, and it's fabulous. But I also feel sometimes it's a bit like a holiday, because then I want to go back to what I call the real world. It's really hard because they're both attractive, but the short person world is a lot easier, I guess. And is that why it's more attractive as deaf culture?
Katie, you've learned sign language. And one of the things that when I went to Frank Barnes last week, all of the kids said to me, why can't you speak sign language? Why are you trying to talk to us when you haven't got sign language? You should be able to speak our language. Mm. And I thought to myself, of course I should. Why haven't I learned BSL? Why don't I know how to speak your language? You've learnt BSL for your son, and lots of other parents aren't able to do that. What's it been like to learn it? Is it difficult?
Yes, it's very difficult. I was quite ignorant to it when I first started to learn BSL. I was under the illusion that I would just replace all the English words with signs and it would be fine. But of course, it's not in the same format as English. So, yes, it's very difficult to master, but it is a beautiful language, very visual, and you use your body to express, which you don't do with English.
At what point did you learn sign language, Tomato? Was it much later on in life? Did your parents learn it so they could talk to you at home?
It's strange, actually, because growing up as a child, I had a teacher of the deaf, and they told my parents, look, you know, you can't use sign language, you know, it's unheard of, it's a dangerous language, you shouldn't do it. And there was also a See Hear programme, which is on the BBC, and I'd never seen it myself. I must have been 14 or 15, but somehow I just sort of saw little bits of sign. So I asked my teacher of the deaf, and I said, you know, I'd really, really like to learn sign language. And they said, no, you know, it's not possible, it's not suitable for you. And then many, many years later, I realised that there was actually a local deaf club in my area. There was loads of people signing, and there was a lot of hidden information from me. You know, I didn't have access to any of that growing up, so I lost out completely.
And this was a few years ago then?
Yeah, that's correct.
So you're 40, can I say that?
I'm 40, yes, and I've got two deaf children, yeah. Beautiful children. I'm very, very busy. But I want them to have a better experience than I had.
Why was BSL seen as a dangerous thing? Like, what was dangerous about it?
I have no idea. Monolingual. I think it's just something that is separated us deaf people to the hearing world. I think it's attitudes and them thinking that the way that we are visual is quite a dangerous thing. And, you know, it changes the way that we come across. I think we're just very visual. We look crazy, but we're not. It's just deaf sort of culture.
One of the things I like, which we touched on a bit with you, Tomato, is this idea of having a different name, a sign name. Now, one of the kids on the audio that we heard there, his name is Jaden, but his sign name is the sign for spider. And I was like, you know, why is that your sign name? And he said he just got obsessed with spiders when he was little, and therefore his sign name is a spider. Katie, do you have a sign name? How did you get one?
I do have a sign name. I was allocated a sign name, if you like.
Ooh. By who?
By a deaf person.
Do you like it? What is it?
Interesting. They tend to pick up on certain characteristics or appearance and use that against you, if you like, when creating your sign name.
Can we ask what yours
got
is?
I've off quite lightly with that.
So what's yours, Katie?
Mine is the letter K and then the sign for stubborn.
Stubborn.
Which is quite fitting, in all fairness.
Charlie, where are your sign names?
I do have a sign name which is like the letter C and taking a photograph, because there was a time when I was really into taking photos. I've tried to change over the years, but you can't really dictate your own sign name. Unfortunately, it's kind of given to you.
It's given to you, and then you can't change it. Tomato, how did you get tomato?
Yeah, my sign's always been almost like a Roman sign. You know, the sort of old Roman mass helmets. And I started meeting a lot of deaf people, and they've just always given me that name. Oh, and also, I think as well, in an American culture, they have their own sign names given to them through tradition. So say, for example, you meet somebody and they have a sign name. It could be anything from, you know, pointing your thumb to your, you know, your upper arm. And because that person is now related to somebody else, and there's more and more generations along the line, they all have the same sign name. But that's an American thing, whereas here we have our own different sign names.
Okay, I mean, I kind of gave Simon a sign name earlier, but am I not allowed because I'm not deaf? Is that bad? I just think it suits him really well, but what sign name would you give Simon Tomato as you're here in front of him?
I need to spend time with him.
I think that's a very good answer.
I need to know who he is.
I think that's the best answer. Thank
what
you.
What do you think of my sign name for Simon? As this, if anyone can't see, I'm making the sign of somebody. Like my two hands coming together to become smaller and smaller.
But she's also got an impish grin going on. It's not just neutral.
No, I'm very happy with it.
I need more time with you. I couldn't possibly. I mean, I'm just thinking actually. The only way that I can work out how to give someone a sign name is by spending more time with them. And I think, yeah, I could definitely create a name for you. No problem.
Another bit that we Caro Sparks, who is a very beautiful, fluent BSL user and does it to sign song. And she was telling me that BSL can be quite direct. She won an award. This was an acting award. And everyone kept going around saying, oh, she's the fat actress.
Other deaf people would say
sorry,
that about her.
Yes, it wasn't other people, just generally. Yeah.
Right.
And is that because of, you know, is that grammar and structure, or is it just kind of, why is BSL a bit more direct?
It's a very visual language. It always has been. They're just very direct people. I mean, for example, there's a woman that's quite well known. Her name is Jenny Selsey. She runs a couple of companies, and Jenny Seeley, and she opened the Paralympics ceremony as well. And she has quite a direct name as well, and that involves her top half, shall we say.
Jenny Seeley, the head of Grey Eye Theatre. Her sign name involves her.
Kate, don't do that.
No,
sign.
Yeah.
Don't do that sign now, please. It's not appropriate in the studio.
Is it this? That's it.
Yes,
okay.
That's the one.
So you're carrying two bags of sugar, that kind of thing.
two big melons.
Charlie,
I'm carrying with me.
Charlie, you must have experience of this. is it that direct? Do you feel you're a more modified sign language user?
Oh, I thought you were asking me about Jenny Seeley. yeah, absolutely. I think that Tomato is absolutely right. I think it is a very visual language, very, you know, it is direct. And you can. And the thing is that I think in English, in spoken language, people can hide things through words. You know, you might say to someone who's maybe gained some weight, oh, you know, you've eaten well recently, or you're looking good, or you're looking well or something. And in sign language, because it's so visual, you just can't usually hide things by how you sign them. So it is just naturally a lot more direct. But the other thing is, and this goes a bit back to the kind of environment that deaf kids are in at school, is that when deaf people are together, you know, usually they don't often have that chance. You know, they're usually around hearing people. When they come together in a deaf club, at a deaf event, or when they're in a classroom at school, they actually often don't want to spend a lot of time beating around the bush. They want to really have that conversation, really say what's been happening to them and express themselves. And so often there's, I think, a sense of urgency as well that makes deaf people a bit more direct.
Katie, it sounds like this is quite a rich and interesting world that Xavier is about to become a part of. I mean, there's part of me that's almost jealous of this world that, you know, we are so outside of, but he's going to be in it.
He already is in it, pretty much since the day he was born. And for me, it's opened my eyes to an entirely new way of life, a new culture that I didn't even know existed. I'd never considered it or thought about it at all before I had Xavier. I'd never met a deaf person. It really wasn't on my radar at all until I had Xavier.
And have you found the same with the language? Are you thinking, goodness me, this can be quite... You're in level two, I think, now, aren't you? And so is it quite brutal and direct for someone who's been speaking?
I don't use it in quite the same way as a deaf person, probably, because I'm hearing. And hearing people have a lot of hang-ups about what is politically correct and how you should articulate yourself. So I probably don't use it quite in the same way as a deaf person would, but yes, they are very direct, and I find it quite amusing.
So you got, and it also says multi-channeling. I was reading about. Mm. What's the distinction with multi-channeling?
A multi-channel sign is a sign that has, it means more than one thing. So, like, if you were saying, "I don't have any" or "haven't got any," there's one sign for that. You wouldn't have to sign "I don't have any."
Very nice. So, quite liking that.
Yeah, it's almost like slang.
So, Katie, how is Xavier learning sign language? Is it all through you, or
yes.
do you go to classes together? Or
no, I go to classes. We have a language aide, a deaf lady, who comes out to our house every other week to teach my other two children, and obviously Xavier is there, but he doesn't really get involved. He's not very interested.
How are your other two kids picking it up? Are they a lot quicker than you, as kids usually are with languages?
They are doing okay. They have to be reminded to use it quite often. They will talk to him and I have to remind them, you need to sign to him because he can't hear you. But I think that's just a children thing. And sometimes they don't want to use it because they just can't be bothered, frankly. They've never had to use it. And all of a sudden now they're expected to communicate in a different way. And it's quite difficult for them. But they do know a fair bit and they will use it generally to speak to their brother, which is nice.
Has Xavier got a sign name yet, or will that come when he...
No, he's got a sign name. I was a little bit not PC and I'm going to apologise because I allocated him a sign name.
Oh, it's OK, I've allocated Simon his. So what's Xavier's?
His is the letter Z and then the sign for eyelashes, because he has ridiculously long eyelashes. It is really quite unfair.
That's gonna help when he's got his expressive face and he's speaking his sign language, isn't he?
Yeah, well, he is. He's quite a character.
Well, that is all we have time for, I'm afraid. Thank you so much to our guests in this second half of our programme, to Marta Leitchie, Casey Rayworth and Charlie Swinburne, and to Tom Shakespeare, Callia Franklin and Beth Whitby from earlier. Thanks also go to our production team, Lee Kumatat, Kathleen Hawkins and our studio manager, Andy Rushton. Producer today was Damon Rose. The Inside Out podcast is back every Friday for the rest of January, you lucky ducks. And then we're back with another hour-long talk show in February.
And in usual style, we leave with some music you heard a little bit earlier. It's MC Geezer from London, a deaf MC and rapper. He says he writes his lyrics about his struggle in life as a deaf person and about deafhood. He makes his own dark hip-hop and glitch-hop beats. That's
you,
what he...
You know what that is, don't you? You love a bit of glitch-hop.
And MC Geezer, we spend hours on our glitch-hip-hop-hop beats. To show the world... Oh, I've lost it. To show the world that anyone can do this if they believe in themselves. You can see a video up on the BBC News site about him, which was made by Kate, who's sitting right next to me.
It was. I got to go to a deaf rave. I've done lots of deaf culture stuff recently. I think somebody's telling me I need to get a bit more involved in learning BSL and being able to communicate with deaf people.
It's a sign.
It was, but the deaf rave was a lot of fun, as you will see in the video. Anyway, the track we're going to hear now is called Deaf Hype. So, until next month, goodbye.
Bye.
Yo, yo, yo. I feel the deaf hype. You feel the deaf hype. You feel the deaf hype. They feel the deaf hype. Hi, 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 hi. Hear how it goes. You all come to this show. I'm on the MIT. Watch my lyric flow. My rhyme is on the glow. Telling you everything I know. I feel the death hat. Had another living in the zero cat. All the bad things are dead cat. if I put us down, thinking deaf people are a bunch of clowns. We ain't no fool, deafer from the old school. We will show our BS terrible. My stand, my rhyme, this time for deaf culture to shine. I feel the deaf hype, you feel the deaf hype, we feel the deaf hype, let's feel the deaf hype. Hi, I feel the deaf hat. Hi, I feel the deaf hat. Hearing, they can't handle how we communicate, though they make us isolate. But we're here to educate, but my style, rap and demonstrate. This is how much we appreciate. Feel the deaf hat, fed up for being you, seeing other people getting abused. We gotta stand up, fight for our right. I have nothing to lose, I'm partying with the deaf grade crew. MC Gida, the deaf raver, giving you the London flavour. We got nothing to be ashamed, we are human just the same. Death Grave, we're making headlines. We're now feeling our baseline. New mood, new style, new way. Death Grave, Ray. Okay. Hi. I feel the death hat. Hi. I feel the death hat. See you on the dance floor, making me go on stage and dine more. By the mood of pumping hardcore, we're all here to explore. Death culture, death culture. Feel the death hat, feel the death hat, feel the death hat, feel the death hat. Come on London Deafy, feel the hat. Come on Northern Deafy, feel the hat. Come on Davin Deafy, feel the hat. Come on UK Deafy, feel the hat. We're gonna make damn noise, so the whole world can feel the death hat. We're gonna make damn vibrations, so the whole world can feel the death hat. We all feeling death hat, yeah? Put your hand in the air. Wave to the left, wave to the right. Left, right, 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 left, right.